He turned to go back to the courtroom. Now he looked back at Johnson.
How'd you know that?
Just a guess. We got jazz acts that come through. New Orleans jazz. You ever want tickets to a show at the El Rey, you look me up.
Yeah, I'll do that. Thanks.
Bosch pushed through the doors leading back into the courtroom. He was smiling, thinking about Johnson's guess about his music. If he was right about that, then maybe he would be right about the jury convicting Jessup. As he moved down the aisle, he heard the judge telling Haller to call his next witness. The state calls Regina Landy. Bosch knew he was on. This part had been choreographed a week earlier by the judge and over the objection of the defense. Regina Landy was unavailable to testify because she was dead. But she had testified in the first trial, and the judge had ruled that her testimony could be read to the current jurors. Brightman now turned to the jurors to offer the explanation, guarding against revealing any hint that there had been an earlier trial.
Ladies and gentlemen, the state has called a witness who is no longer available to testify. However, previously she gave sworn testimony that we will read to you today. You are not to consider why this witness is unable to testify or where this previous sworn testimony is from. Your concern is the testimony itself. I should add that I have decided to allow this over the objection of the defense. The U.S. Constitution holds that the accused is entitled to question his accusers. However, as you will see, this witness was indeed questioned by an attorney who previously represented Mr. Jessup.
She turned back to the court. You may proceed, Mr. Haller. Haller called Bosch to the stand. He was sworn in and then took the seat, pulling the microphone into position. He opened the blue binder he had carried with him, and Haller began. Detective Bosch, can you tell us a little bit about your experience as a law enforcement officer? Bosch turned toward the jury box and moved his eyes over the faces of the jurors as he answered. He did not leave the alternates out.
I've been a sworn officer for 36 years. I've spent more than 25 of those years working homicides. I've been the lead investigator in more than 200 murder investigations in that time.
And you are the lead investigator on this case?
Yes, I am now. I did not take part in the original investigation, however. I came into this case in February of this year.
Thank you, Detective. We will be talking about your investigation later in the trial. Are you prepared to read the sworn testimony of Regina Landy, taken on October 7th, 1986?
I am.
Okay, I will read the questions that were posed at the time by Deputy District Attorney Gary Lentz and Defense Counsel Charles Bernard, and you will read the responses from the witness. We start with direct examination from Mr. Lentz. Haller paused and studied the transcript in front of him. Bosch wondered if there would be any confusion from his reading the responses of a woman. In deciding to allow the testimony the week before, the judge had disallowed any reference to emotions described as having been exhibited by Regina Landy. Bosch knew from the transcript that she was crying throughout her testimony, but he would not be able to communicate that to the present jurors. Here we go, Haller said. Mrs. Landy, can you please describe your relationship with the victim, Melissa Landy?
I am her mother, Bosch read. She was my daughter, until she was taken away from me.
Chapter 27. Monday, April 5th, 1:45 p.m. The reading of Regina Landy's testimony from the first trial took us right up to lunch. The testimony was needed to establish who the victim was and who had identified her. But without the incumbent emotion of a parent's testimony, the reading by Bosch was largely procedural, and while the first witness of the day brought reason to be hopeful, the second witness was about as anticlimactic as a voice from the grave could possibly be. I imagined that Bosch's reading of Regina Landy's words was confusing to the jurors when they were not provided with any explanation for her absence from the trial of her daughter's alleged killer. The prosecution team had lunch at Duffy's, which was close enough to the CCB to be convenient, but far enough away that we wouldn't have to worry about jurors finding the same place to eat. Nobody was ecstatic about the start of the trial, but that was to be expected. I had planned the presentation of evidence, like the unfolding of Scheherazade, the symphonic suite that starts slow and quiet and builds to an all-encompassing crescendo of sound and music and emotion. The first day was about the proof of facts. I had to bring forward the body. I had to establish that there was a victim, that she had been taken from her home and later found dead, and that she had been murdered. I had hit two of those facts with the first witnesses, and now the afternoon witness, the medical examiner, would complete the proof. The prosecution's case would then shift toward the accused and the evidence that would tie him to the crime. That would be when my case would really come to life. Only Bosch and I came back from lunch. Maggie had gone over to the Checkers Hotel to spend the afternoon with our star witness, Sarah Ann Gleason. Bosch had gone up to Washington on Saturday and flown down with her on Sunday morning. She wasn't scheduled to testify until Wednesday morning, but I had wanted her close, and I had wanted Maggie to spend as much time as possible prepping her for her part in the trial. Maggie had already been up to Washington twice to spend time with her, but I believed that any time they could spend together would continue to promote the bond I wanted them to have and the jury to see. Maggie left us reluctantly. She was concerned that I would make a misstep in court without her there, watching over me as my second. I assured her that I could handle the direct examination of a medical examiner and would call her if I ran into trouble. Little did I know how important this witness's testimony would come to be. The afternoon session got off to a late start while we waited 10 minutes for a juror who did not return from lunch on time. Once the panel was assembled and returned to court, Judge Brightman lectured the jurors again on timeliness and ordered them to eat as a group for the remainder of the trial. She also ordered the courtroom deputy to escort them to lunch. This way, no one would stray from the pack, and no one would be late. Finished with the lunch business, the judge gruffly ordered me to call my next witness. I nodded to Bosch, and he headed to the witness room to retrieve David Eisenbach. The judge grew impatient as we waited, but it took Eisenbach a few minutes longer than most witnesses to make his way into the courtroom and to the witness stand. Eisenbach was 79 years old and walked with a cane. He also carried a pillow with a handle on it, as if he were going to a USC football game at the Coliseum. After being sworn in, he placed the pillow on the hard wood of the witness chair and then sat down. "Dr. Eisenbach," I began, "can you tell the jury what you do for a living?"
"Currently, I am semi-retired and derive an income from being an autopsy consultant. A gun for hire, you lawyers like to call it. I review autopsies for a living and then tell lawyers and juries what the medical examiner did right and did wrong."
"And before you were semi-retired, what did you do?"
"I was assistant medical examiner for the County of Los Angeles. Had that job for 30 years.
"As such, you conducted autopsies?"
"Yes, sir, I did. In 30 years, I conducted over 20,000 autopsies. That's a lot of dead people."
"That is a lot, Dr. Eisenbach. Do you remember them all?"
"Of course not. I remember a handful off the top of my head. The rest of them I would need my notes to remember."
After receiving permission from the judge, I approached the witness stand and put down a 40-page document. "I draw your attention to the document I have placed before you. Can you identify it?"
"Yes, it's an autopsy protocol dated February 18, 1986. The deceased is listed as Melissa Teresa Landy. My name is also on it. It is one of mine."
"Meaning you conducted the autopsy?"
"Yes, that is what I said."
I followed this with a series of questions that established the autopsy procedures and the general health of the victim prior to death. Royce objected several times to what he termed leading questions. Few of these were sustained by the judge, but that was not the point. Royce had adopted the tactic of attempting to get me out of rhythm by incessantly interrupting, whether such interruptions were valid or not. Working around these interruptions, Eisenbach was able to testify that Melissa Landy was in perfect health until the moment of her violent death. He said she had not been sexually attacked in any determinable way. He said there was no indication of prior sexual activity. She was a virgin. He said the cause of her death was asphyxiation. He said the evidence of crushed bones in her neck and throat indicated she had been choked by a powerful force, a man's single hand. Using a laser pointer to mark locations on photographs of the body taken at autopsy, Eisenbach identified a bruise pattern on the victim's neck that was indicative of a one-handed chokehold. With the laser pointer, he delineated a thumb mark on the right side of the girl's neck and the larger forefinger mark on the left side. Doctor, did you make a determination of which hand the killer used to choke the victim to death?
Yes, it was quite simple to determine the killer had used the right hand to choke this girl to death.
Just one hand?
That is correct.
Was there any determination of how this was done? Had the girl been suspended while she was choked?
No, the injuries, particularly the crushed bones, indicated that the killer put his hand on her neck and pressed her against a surface that offered resistance.
Could that have been the seat of a vehicle?
Yes.
How about a man's leg? Royce objected, saying the question called for pure speculation. The judge agreed and told me to move on. Doctor, you mentioned 20,000 autopsies. I assume that many of these were homicides involving asphyxiation. Was it unusual to come across a case where only one hand was used to choke a victim to death? Royce objected again, this time saying the question asked for an answer outside the witness's expertise. But this time the judge went my way.
The man has conducted 20,000 autopsies, she said. I'm inclined to think that gives him a lot of expertise. I'm going to allow the question.
You can answer, doctor, I said. Was this unusual?
Not necessarily. Many homicides occur during struggles and other circumstances. I've seen it before. If one hand is otherwise occupied, the other must suffice. We are talking about a 12-year-old girl who weighed 91 pounds. She could have been subdued with one hand if the killer needed the left hand for something else.
Would driving a vehicle fall into that category?
Objection, Royce said. Same argument.
And same ruling, Brightman said. You may answer, doctor.
Yes, Eisenbach said. If one hand was being used to maintain control of a vehicle, the other hand could be used to choke the victim. That is one possibility.
At this point, I believed I had gotten all there was to get from Eisenbach. I ended direct examination and handed the witness over to Royce. Unfortunately for me, Eisenbach was a witness who had something for everybody, and Royce went after it.
One possibility. Is that what you called it, Dr. Eisenbach?
Excuse me?
You said the scenario Mr. Haller described, one hand on the wheel, one hand on the neck, was one possibility. Is that correct?
Yes, that is a possibility.
But you weren't there, so you can't know for sure. Isn't that right, Doctor?
Yes, that is right.
You said one possibility.
What are some of the other possibilities?
Well, I wouldn't know. I was responding to the question from the prosecutor.
How about a cigarette?
What?
Could the killer have been holding a cigarette in his left hand while he choked the girl with his right?
Yes, I suppose so. Yes.
And how about his penis?
His
penis, doctor. Could the killer have choked the girl with his right hand while holding his penis with his left?
I would have to... Yes, that is a possibility, too.
He could have been masturbating with one hand while he choked her with the other. Correct, doctor.
Anything is possible,
but there is no indication in the autopsy report that supports this.
What about what is not in the file, Doctor?
I'm not aware of anything.
Is this what you meant about being a hired gun, Doctor? You take the prosecution side no matter what the facts are.
I don't always work for prosecutors.
I'm happy for you. I stood up.
Your Honor, he's badgering the witness with Mr. Royce, the judge said. Please keep it civil and on point.
Yes, Your Honor.
Doctor, of the 20,000 autopsies you have performed, how many of them were on victims of sexually motivated violence?
Eisenbach looked across the floor to me, but there was nothing I could do for him. Bosch had taken Maggie's place at the prosecution table. He leaned over to me and whispered,
What's he doing? Trying to make our case?
I held up my hand so I would not be distracted from the back and forth between Royce and Eisenbach.
No, he's making their case, I whispered back.
Eisenbach still hadn't answered.
Doctor, the judge said, please answer the question.
I don't have a count, but many of them were sexually motivated crimes.
Was this one?
Based on the autopsy findings, I could not make that conclusion. But whenever you have a young child, particularly a female, and there is a stranger abduction, then you are almost always...
Move to strike the answer as non-responsive,
Royce said, cutting the witness off.
The witness is assuming facts not in evidence.
The judge considered the objection. I stood up, ready to respond, but said nothing.
Doctor, please answer only the question you are asked, the judge said.
I thought I was, Eisenbach said.
Then let me be more specific, Royce said. You found no indications of sexual assault or abuse on the body of Melissa Landy. Is that correct, Doctor?
That is correct.
What about on the victim's clothing?
The body is my jurisdiction. The clothing is analyzed by forensics.
Of course. Royce hesitated and looked down at his notes. I could tell he was trying to decide how far to take something. It was a case of so far, so good. Do I risk going further? Finally, he decided.
Now, Doctor,
a moment ago, when I objected to your answer, you called this a stranger abduction. What evidence from the autopsy supported that claim? Eisenbach thought for a long moment and even looked down at the autopsy report in front of him.
Doctor?
There is nothing I recall from the autopsy alone that supports this.
Actually, the autopsy supports a conclusion quite the opposite, doesn't it? Eisenbach looked genuinely confused.
I'm not sure what you mean.
Can I draw your attention to page 8 of the autopsy protocol, the preliminary examination of the body? Royce waited a moment until Eisenbach turned to the page. I did as well, but didn't need to. I knew where Royce was going and couldn't stop him. I just needed to be ready to object at the right moment.
Doctor, the report states that scrapings of the victim's fingernails were negative for blood and tissue. Do you see that on page 8?
Yes, I scraped her nails, but they were clean.
This indicates she did not scratch her attacker, her killer, correct?
That would be the indication, yes.
And this would also indicate that she knew her attack...
Objection!
I was on my feet, but not quick enough. Royce had gotten the suggestion out and to the jury.
Assumes facts not in evidence, I said.
Your Honor, defense counsel is clearly attempting to plant seeds with a jury that do not exist.
Sustained. Mr. Royce, a warning.
Yes, Your Honor.
The defense has no further questions for this prosecution witness.
Chapter 28, Monday, April 5th,
4:45 p.m. Bosch knocked on the door of room 804 and looked directly at the peephole. The door was quickly opened by McPherson, who was checking her watch as she stood back to let him enter.
"Why aren't you in court with Mickey?"
she asked. Bosch entered. The room was a suite with a decent view of Grand Avenue and the back of the Biltmore. There was a couch and two chairs, one of them occupied by Sarah Ann Gleason. Bosch nodded his hello.
"Because he doesn't need me there. I'm needed here."
"What's going on?"
"Royce tipped his hand on the defense's case. I need to talk to Sarah about it."
He started toward the couch, but McPherson put her hand on his arm and stopped him.
"Wait a minute. Before you talk to Sarah, you talk to me. What's going on?"
Bosch nodded. She was right. He looked around, but there was no place for private conversation in the suite.
"Let's take a walk."
McPherson went to the coffee table and grabbed a key card.
"We'll be right back, Sarah. Do you need anything?"
"No, I'm fine. I'll be here." She held up a sketch pad. It would keep her company. Bosch and McPherson left the room and took the elevator down to the lobby. There was a bar crowded with pre-happy hour drinkers, but they found a private spot in a sitting area by the front door.
"Okay, how did Royce tip his hand?"
McPherson asked.
"When he was cross-examining Eisenbach, he riffed off of Mickey's question about the killer using only his right hand to choke her."
"Right, while he was driving. He panicked when he heard the call on the police radio and killed her."
"Right, that's the prosecution theory. Well, Royce is already setting up a defense theory. On cross, he asked whether it was possible that the killer was choking her with one hand while masturbating with the other."
She was silent as she computed this.
"This is the old prosecution theory," she said, "from the first trial. That it was murder in the commission of a sex act. Mickey and I sort of figured that once Royce got all the discovery material and learned that the DNA came from the stepfather, the defense would play it this way. They're setting up the stepfather as the straw man. They'll say he killed her, and the DNA proves it."
McPherson folded her arms as she worked it out further.
"It's good, but there are two things wrong with it. Sarah and the hair evidence. So we're missing something. Royce has got to have something or someone who discredits Sarah's ID."
"That's why I'm here. I brought Royce's witness list. These people have been playing hide-and-seek with me, and I haven't run them all down. Sarah's got to look at this list and tell me which one I need to focus on."
"How the hell will she know?"
"She's got to. These are her people. Boyfriends, husbands, fellow tweakers. All of them have records. They're the people she hung out with before she got straight. Every address is a last known and worthless. Royce has got to be hiding them."
McPherson nodded.
"That's why they call him Clever Clive. Okay, let's talk to her. Let me try first, okay?"
She stood up.
"Wait a minute," Bosch said.
She looked at him.
"What is it?"
"What if the defense theory is the right one?"
"Are you kidding me?"
He didn't answer, and she didn't wait long. She headed back toward the elevator. He got up and followed. They went back to the room. Bosch noticed that Gleason had sketched a tulip on her pad while they had been gone. He sat down on the couch across from her, and McPherson took the chair right next to her.
"Sarah," McPherson said, "we need to talk. We think that somebody you used to know during those lost years we were talking about is going to try to help the defense. We need to figure out who it is and what they are going to say."
"I don't understand," Sarah said.
"I was 13 years old when this happened to us. What does it matter who my friends were after?"
"It matters because they can testify about things you might have done or said."
"What things?"
McPherson shook her head.
"That's what is so frustrating. We don't really know. We only know that today in court the defense made it clear that they are going to try to put the blame for your sister's death on your stepfather.
Sarah raised her hands, as if warding off a blow.
That's crazy. I was there. I saw that man take her.
We know that, Sarah. But it's a matter of what is conveyed to the jury, and what and who the jurors believe. Now, Detective Bosch has a list of the defense's witnesses. I want you to take a look at it, and tell us what the names mean to you.
Bosch pulled the list from his briefcase. He handed it to McPherson, who handed it to Sarah.
Sorry, all those notes are things I added, Bosch said. When I was trying to track them down, just look at the names.
Bosch watched her lips move slightly as she started to read. Then they stopped moving, and she just stared at the paper. He saw tears in her eyes.
Sarah? McPherson prompted.
These people, Gleason said in a whisper. I thought I'd never see them again.
You may never see them again, McPherson said. Just because they're on that list, it doesn't mean they'll be called. They pull names out of the records and load up the list to confuse us, Sarah. It's called haystacking. They hide the real witnesses, and our investigator, Detective Bosch, wastes his time checking out the wrong people. But there's got to be at least one name on there that counts. Who is it, Sarah? Help us.
She stared at the list without responding.
Someone who will be able to say you two were close, who you spent time with and told secrets to.
I thought a husband couldn't testify against a wife, Gleason said.
One spouse can't be forced to testify against the other. But what are you talking about, Sarah?
This one.
She pointed to a name on the list. Bosch leaned over to read it. Edward Roman. Bosch had traced him to a lockdown rehab in North Hollywood, where Sarah had spent 9 months after her last incarceration. The only thing Bosch had guessed was that they'd had contact in group therapy. The last known address provided by Royce was a motel in Van Nuys, but Roman was long gone from there. Bosch had gotten no further with it and had dismissed the name as part of Royce's haystack.
Roman, he said. You were with him in rehab, right?
Yes, Gleason said. Then we got married.
When? McPherson said. We have no record of that marriage.
After we got out. He knew a minister. We got married on the beach. But it didn't last very long.
Did you get divorced? McPherson asked.
No, I never really cared. Then when I got straight, I just didn't want to go back there. It was one of those things you block out, like it didn't happen.
McPherson looked at Bosch.
It might not have been a legal marriage, he said. There's nothing in the county records.
Doesn't matter if it was a legal marriage or not, she said. He is obviously a volunteer witness so he can testify against her. What matters is what his testimony is going to be. What's he going to say, Sarah?
Sarah slowly shook her head.
I don't know.
Well, what did you tell him about your sister and your stepfather?
I don't know. Those years. I can hardly remember anything from back then.
There was a silence, and then McPherson asked Sarah to look at the rest of the names on the list. She did, and shook her head.
I don't know who some of these people are. Some people in the life, I just knew them by street names.
But Edward Roman, you know.
Yes, we were together.
How long?
Gleason shook her head in embarrassment.
Not long. Inside rehab, we thought we were made for each other. Once we were out, it didn't work. It lasted maybe 3 months. I got arrested again, and when I got out of jail, he was gone.
Is it possible that it wasn't a legitimate marriage?
Gleason thought for a moment and half-heartedly shrugged.
Anything is possible, I guess.
Okay, Sarah, I'm going to step out with Detective Bosch again for a few minutes. I want you to think about Edward Roman. Anything you can remember will be helpful. I'll be right back.
McPherson took the witness list from her and handed it back to Bosch. They left the room, but just took a few paces down the hallway before stopping and talking in whispers.
"I guess you'd better find him," she said.
"It won't matter," Bosch said. "If he's Royce's star witness, he won't talk to me."
"Then find out everything you can about him, so when the time comes, we can destroy him."
"Got it."
Bosch turned and headed down the hall toward the elevators. McPherson called after him. He stopped and looked back.
"Did you mean it?"
McPherson asked.
"Mean what?"
"What you said down in the lobby. What you asked. You think 24 years ago, she made it all up?"
Bosch looked at her for a long moment, then shrugged.
"I don't know."
"Well, what about the hair in the truck? Doesn't that tie her story in?"
Bosch held a hand up empty.
"It's circumstantial, and I wasn't there when they found it."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"It means sometimes things happen when the victim is a child.
And that I wasn't there when they found it."
"Boy, maybe you should be working for the defense."
Bosch dropped his hand to the side.
"I'm sure they've thought of all of this already."
He turned back toward the elevators and headed down the hallway. Chapter 29. Tuesday, April 6th, 9 a.m. Sometimes, the wheels of justice roll smoothly. The second day of trial started exactly as scheduled. The full jury was in the box, the judge was on the bench, and Jason Jessup and his attorney were seated at the defense table. I stood and called my first witness of what I hoped would be a productive day for the prosecution. Harry Bosch even had Izzy Gordon in the courtroom ready to go. By 5 minutes after the hour, she was sworn in and seated. She was a small woman with black framed glasses that magnified her eyes. My record said she was 50 years old, but she looked older. "Ms. Gordon, can you tell the jury what you do for a living?"
"Yes. I am a forensic technician and crime scene supervisor for the Los Angeles Police Department. I have been so employed in the forensics unit since 1986.
"Were you so employed on February 16th of that year?"
"Yes, I was. It was my first day of work."
"And what was your assignment on that day?"
"My job was to learn. I was assigned to a crime scene supervisor, and I was to get on-the-job training."
Izzy Gordon was a major find for the prosecution. Two technicians and a supervisor had worked the three separate crime scenes relating to the Melissa Landy case: the home on Windsor, the trash bin behind the El Rey, and the tow truck driven by Jessup. Gordon had been assigned to be at the supervisor's side and therefore had been in attendance at all three crime scenes. The supervisor was long since dead, and the other techs retired and unable to offer testimony about all three locations. Finding Gordon allowed me to streamline the introduction of crime scene evidence. "Who was that supervisor?"
"That was Art Donovan."
"And you got a call out with him that day?"
"Yes, we did. An abduction that turned into a homicide. We ended up going from scene to scene to scene that day, three related locations."
"Okay, let's take those scenes one at a time." Over the next 90 minutes, I walked Gordon through her Sunday tour of crime scenes on February 16th, 1986. Using her as the conduit, I could deliver crime scene photographs, videos, and evidence reports. Royce continued his tack of objecting at will in an effort to prevent the unimpeded flow of information to the jury. But he was scoreless and getting under the judge's skin. I could tell, and so I did not complain. I wanted that annoyance to fester. It might come in handy later. Gordon's testimony was fairly pedestrian, as she first discussed the unsuccessful efforts to find shoe prints and other trace evidence on the front lawn of the Landy's house. It turned more dramatic when she recalled being urgently called to a new crime scene, the trash bin behind the El Rey.
"We were called when they found the body. It was handled in whispers because the family was there in the house, and we did not want to upset them until it was confirmed that there was a body and that it was the little girl."
You and Donovan went to the El Rey Theater?
Yes, along with Detective Kloster. We met the assistant medical examiner there. We now had a homicide, so more technicians were called in, too.
The El Rey portion of Gordon's testimony was largely an opportunity for me to show more video footage and photographs of the victim on the overhead screens. If nothing else, I wanted every juror in the box to be incensed by what they saw. I wanted to light the fire of one of the basic instincts, vengeance. I counted on Royce to object, and he did. But by then, he had exhausted his welcome with the judge, and his argument that the images were graphic and cumulatively excessive fell on deaf ears. They were allowed. Finally, Izzy Gordon brought us to the last crime scene, the tow truck, and she described how she had spotted three long hairs caught in the crack that split the bench seat and pointed them out to Donovan for collection. "What happened to those hairs?" I asked.
"They were individually bagged and tagged, and then taken to the Scientific Investigation Division for comparison and analysis."
Gordon's testimony was smooth and efficient. When I turned her over to the defense, Royce did the best he could. He did not bother to assail the collection of evidence, but merely attempted once again to gain a foothold for the defense theory. In doing so, he skipped the first two crime scenes and zeroed in on the tow truck.
"Miss Gordon, when you got to the Aardvark towing yard, were there police officers already there?"
"Yes, of course."
"How many?"
"I didn't count, but there were several."
"What about detectives?"
"Yes, there were detectives conducting a search of the whole business under the authority of a search warrant."
"And were these detectives you had seen earlier at the previous crime scenes?"
"I think so, yes. I would assume so, but I do not remember specifically."
"But you seem to remember other things specifically. Why don't you remember which detectives you were working with?"
"There were several people working this case. Detective Kloster was the lead investigator, but he was dealing with three different locations, as well as the girl who was the witness. I don't remember if he was at the tow yard when I first arrived, but he was there at some point. I think that if you refer to the crime scene attendance logs, you will be able to determine who is at what scene and when."
"Ah, then we shall do just that."
Royce approached the witness stand and gave Gordon three documents and a pencil. He then returned to the lectern.
"What are those three documents, Ms. Gordon?"
"These are crime scene attendance logs."
"And which scenes are they from?"
"The three I worked in regard to the Landy case."
"Can you please take a moment to study those logs and use the pencil I've given you to circle any name that appears on all three lists?"
It took Gordon less than a minute to complete the task.
"Finished?" Royce asked.
"Yes, there are four names."
"Can you tell us?"
"Yes, myself and my supervisor, Art Donovan, and then Detective Kloster and his partner, Chad Steiner."
"You were the only four who were at all three crime scenes that day, correct?"
"That is correct."
Maggie leaned into me and whispered,
"Cross-scene contamination."
I shook my head slightly and whispered back, "That suggests accidental contamination. I think he's going for intentional planting of evidence." Maggie nodded and leaned away. Royce asked his next question.
"Being one of only four who were at all four scenes, you had a keen understanding of this crime and what it meant. Isn't that correct?"
"I'm not sure what you mean."
"Among police personnel, were emotions high at these crime scenes?"
"Well, everyone was very professional."
"You mean nobody cared that this was a 12-year-old girl?"
"No, we cared. And you could say things were at least tense at the first two scenes. We had the family at one, and the dead little girl at the other. I don't really remember things being emotional at the tow yard."
Wrong answer, I thought. She had opened a door for the defense.
"Okay," Royce said. "But you are saying that at the first two scenes the emotions were high, correct?"
I stood up, just to give Royce a dose of his own medicine.
"Objection. Asked and answered already, Your Honor."
"Sustained."
Royce was undaunted.
Then how did these emotions display themselves? He asked.
Well, we talked. Art Donovan told me to keep professional detachment. He said we had to do our best work because this had been just a little girl.
What about Detectives Kloster and Steiner?
They said the same thing, that we couldn't leave any stone unturned, that we had to do it for Melissa.
He called the victim by her name.
Yes, I remember that.
How angry and upset would you say Detective Kloster was?
I stood and objected.
Assumes facts not in evidence or testimony.
The judge sustained it and told Royce to move on.
Miss Gordon, can you refer to the crime scene attendance log still in front of you and tell us if the arrival and departure of law enforcement personnel is kept by time?
Yes, it is. There are arrival and departure times listed after each name.
You have previously stated that Detectives Kloster and Steiner were the only two investigators beside yourself and your supervisor to appear at all three scenes.
Yes, they were the lead investigators on the case.
Did they arrive at each of the scenes before you and Mr. Donovan?
It took Gordon a moment to confirm the information on the lists.
Yes, they did.
So, they would have had access to the victim's body before you ever arrived at the El Rey Theater, correct?
I don't know what you mean by access, but yes, they were on scene first.
And so, they would have also had access to the tow truck before you got there and saw the three strands of hair conveniently caught in the seat crack, correct?
I objected, saying the question required the witness to speculate on things she would not have witnessed and was argumentative because of the use of the word conveniently. Royce was obviously playing to the jury. The judge told Royce to rephrase the question without taking editorial license.
The detectives would have had access to the tow truck before you got there and before you were the first to see the three strands of hair lodged in the seat crack, correct?
Gordon took the hint from my objection and answered the way I wanted her to.
I don't know, because I wasn't there.
Still, Royce had gotten his point across to the jury. He had also gotten the point of his case across to me. It was now fair to assume that the defense would put forth the theory that the police, in the person of Kloster and or his partner Steiner, had planted the hair evidence to secure a conviction of Jessup after he had been identified by the 13-year-old Sarah. Further to this, the defense would posit that Sarah's wrongful identification of Jessup was intentional and part of the Landy family's effort to hide the fact that Melissa had died either accidentally or intentionally at the hands of her stepfather. It would be a tough road to take. To be successful, it would take at least one person on the jury buying into what amounted to two conspiracies working independently of one another and yet in concert. But I could think of only two defense attorneys in town who could pull it off, and Royce was one of them. I had to be prepared.
What happened after you noticed the hair on the tow truck seat? Do you remember?
Royce asked the witness.
I pointed it out to Art because he was doing the actual collection of evidence. I was just there to observe and gather experience.
Were Detectives Kloster and Steiner called over to take a look?
Yes, I believe so.
Do you recall what, if anything, they did then?
I don't recall them doing anything in relation to the hair evidence. It was their case, and so they were notified of the evidence find, and that was it.
Were you happy with yourself?
I don't think I understand.
It was your first day on the job, your first case. Were you pleased with yourself after spotting the hair evidence? Were you proud?
Gordon hesitated before answering, as if trying to figure out if the question was a trap.
I was pleased that I had contributed, yes. And did you ever wonder why you, the rookie, spotted the hair in the seat crack before your supervisor or the two lead investigators?
Gordon hesitated again and then said no. Royce said he had no further questions. It had been an excellent cross, planting multiple seeds that could later bloom into something larger in the defense case.
I did what I could on redirect, asking Gordon to recite the names of the 6 uniformed police officers and 2 other detectives who were listed as arriving ahead of Kloster and Steiner on the crime scene attendance log, kept at the location where Melissa Landy's body was found. So, hypothetically, if Detective Kloster or Steiner had wanted to take hair from the victim to plant elsewhere, they would have had to do it under the noses of 8 other officers, or enlist them in allowing them to do it. Is that correct? Yes, it would seem so. I thanked the witness and sat down. Royce then went back to the lectern for recross. Also, hypothetically, if Kloster or Steiner wanted to plant hair from the victim at the 3rd crime scene, it would not have been necessary to take it directly from the victim's head if there were other sources for it, correct? I guess not, if there were other sources. For example, a hairbrush in the victim's home could have provided hair to them, correct? I guess so. They were in the victim's home, weren't they? Yes, that was one of the locations where they signed in. Nothing further. Royce had nailed me, and I decided not to pursue this any further. Royce would have a comeback no matter what I brought forward from the witness. Gordon was dismissed, and the judge broke for lunch. I told Bosch that he would be on the stand after the break, reading Kloster's testimony into the record. I asked if he wanted to grab lunch together to talk about the defense's theory, but he said he couldn't, that he had something to do. Maggie was heading over to the hotel to have lunch with Sarah Ann Gleason, so that left me on my own, or so I thought. As I headed down the center aisle to the rear door of the courtroom, an attractive woman stepped out of the back row in front of me. She smiled and stepped up to me. "Mr. Haller, I'm Rachel Walling with the FBI." At first it didn't compute, but then the name caught on a memory prompt somewhere inside. "Yes, the profiler. You distracted my investigator with your theory that Jason Jessup is a serial killer."
"Well, I hope it was more help than distraction."
"I guess that remains to be seen. What can I do for you, Agent Walling?"
"I was going to ask if you might have time for lunch, but since you consider me a distraction, then maybe I should just..."
"Guess what, Agent Walling? You're in luck. I'm free. Let's have lunch." I pointed to the door, and we headed out. Chapter 30. Tuesday, April 6th, 1:15 p.m. This time, it was the judge who was late returning to court. The prosecution and defense teams were seated at the appointed time and ready to go, but there was no sign of Brightman. And there had been no indication from the clerk as to whether the delay was because of personal business or some sort of trial issue. Bosch got up from his seat at the railing and approached Haller, tapping him on the back. "Harry, we're about to start. You ready?"
"I'm ready, but we need to talk."
"What's wrong?" Bosch turned his body so his back was to the defense table and lowered his voice into a barely audible whisper.
"I went to see the SIS guys at lunch. They showed me some stuff you need to know about."
He was being overly cryptic, but the photos Lieutenant Wright had showed him from the surveillance the night before were troubling. Jessup was up to something, and whatever it might be, it was going to go down soon. Before Haller could respond, the background hubbub of the courtroom ceased as the judge took the bench. "After court," Haller whispered. He then turned back to the front of the courtroom, and Bosch returned to his seat at the railing. The judge told the deputy to seat the jury, and soon everyone was in place.
"I want to apologize," Brightman said. "This delay was my responsibility. I had a personal matter come up, and it took far longer than I expected it would. Mr. Haller, please call your next witness."
Haller stood and called for Doral Kloster. Bosch stood and headed for the witness stand while the judge once again explained to the jury that the witness called by the prosecution was unavailable and that prior sworn testimony would be read by Bosch and Haller. Though all of this had been worked out in a pre-trial hearing and over the objection of the defense,
Royce stood once again and objected.
Mr. Royce, we've already argued this issue, the judge responded.
I would ask that the court reconsider its ruling, as this form of testimony entirely undercuts Mr. Jessup's constitutional right to confront his accusers. Detective Kloster was not asked the questions I would want to ask him, based on the defense's current view of the case.
Again, Mr. Royce, this issue has been settled, and I do not wish to rehash it in front of the jury.
But, Your Honor, I am being inhibited from presenting a full defense.
Mr. Royce, I have been very generous in allowing you to posture in front of the jury. My patience is now growing thin. You may sit down.
Royce stared the judge down. Bosch knew what he was doing, playing to the jury. He wanted them to see him and Jessup as the underdogs. He wanted them to understand that it was not just the prosecution against Jessup, but the judge as well. When he had drawn out the stare as long as he dared, he spoke again.
Judge, I cannot sit down when my client's freedom is at stake. This is an egregious... Brightman angrily slammed her hand down, making a sound as loud as a shot.
We are not going to do this in front of the jury, Mr. Royce. Will the jurors please return to the assembly room?
Wide-eyed and alert to the tension that had engulfed the courtroom, the jurors filed out, to a person glancing back over their shoulders to check the action behind them. The whole time, Royce held his glare on the judge, and Bosch knew it was mostly an act. This was exactly what Royce wanted, for the jury to see him being persecuted and prevented from bringing his case forward. It didn't matter that they would be sequestered in the jury room. They all knew that Royce was about to get slapped down hard by the judge. Once the door to the jury assembly room was closed, the judge turned back to Royce. In the 30 seconds it had taken the jury to leave the courtroom, she had obviously calmed down.
Mr. Royce, at the end of the trial, we will be holding a contempt hearing during which your actions today will be examined and penalized. Until then, if I ever order you to sit down and you refuse that order, I will have the courtroom deputy forcibly place you in your seat, and it will not matter to me if the jury is present or not. Do you understand?
Yes, Your Honor. And I would like to apologize for allowing the emotions of the moment to get the best of me.
Very well, Mr. Royce. You will now sit down, and we'll bring the jury back in.
They held each other's eyes for a long moment, until Royce finally, and slowly, sat down. The judge then told the courtroom deputy to bring the jurors back in. Bosch glanced at the jury as they came back in. They all had their eyes on Royce, and Harry could see the defense attorney's gambit had worked. He saw sympathy in their eyes, as if they all knew that at any moment they might cross the judge and be similarly rebuked. They didn't know what happened while they were behind the closed door, but Royce was like the kid who had been sent to the principal's office and had returned to tell everyone about it at recess. The judge addressed the jury before continuing the trial.
I want the members of the jury to understand that in a trial of this nature, emotions sometimes run high. Mr. Royce and I have discussed the issue, and it is resolved. You are to pay it no mind. So let's proceed with the reading of prior sworn testimony. Mr. Haller?
Yes, Your Honor. Haller stood and went to the lectern with his printout of Doral Kloster's testimony. Detective Bosch, you are still under oath. Do you have the transcript of sworn testimony provided by Detective Doral Kloster on October 8, 1986?
Yes, I do.
Bosch placed the transcript on the stand and took a pair of reading glasses out of his jacket's inside pocket. Okay, then once again, I will read the questions that were posed to Detective Kloster under oath by Deputy District Attorney Gary Lintz, and you will read the responses from the witness. After a series of questions used to elicit basic information about Kloster, the testimony moved quickly
into the investigation of the murder of Melissa Landy. Now, Detective, you are assigned to a detective squad at Wilshire Division, correct?
Yes, I am on the homicide and major crimes table.
And this case did not start out as a homicide?
No, it did not. My partner and I were called in from home after patrol units were dispatched to the Landy house, and a preliminary investigation determined that it appeared to be a stranger abduction. That made it a major crime, and we were called out.
What happened when you got to the Landy house?
We initially separated the individuals there, the mother, father, and Sarah, the sister, and conducted interviews. We then brought the family together and conducted a joint interview. It often works best that way, and it did this time. In the joint interview, we found our investigative direction.
Tell us about that. How did you find this direction?
In the individual interview, Sarah revealed that the girls had been playing a hide-and-seek game and that she was hiding behind some bushes at the front corner of her house. These bushes blocked her view of the street. She said she heard a trash truck and saw a trash man cross the yard and grab her sister. These events occurred on a Sunday, so we knew there was no city trash pickup. But when I had Sarah recount this story in front of her parents, her father quickly said that on Sunday mornings, several tow trucks patrol the neighborhood, and that the drivers wear overalls like the city sanitation workers do. And that became our first lead.
And how did you follow that lead?
We were able to obtain a list of city-licensed tow truck companies that operated in the Wilshire District. By this time, I had called in more detectives and we split the list up. There were only three companies that were operating on that day. Each pair of detectives took one. My partner and I went to a tow yard on La Brea Boulevard that was operated by a business called Aardvark Towing.
And what happened when you got there?
We found that they were about to shut down for the day because they essentially worked no parking zones around churches. By noon, they were done. There were three drivers, and they were securing things and about to head out when we got there. They all voluntarily agreed to identify themselves and answer our questions. While my partner asked preliminary questions, I went back to our car and called their names into central dispatch so they could check them for criminal records.
Who were these men, Detective Kloster?
Their names were William.